Today, I'm interviewing Ruth Pawanka, Village Historian of Kinderhook. Thank you so much, Ruth, to having me interview you today.
I'm really glad to do that and to be able to tell you about the Persons of Color Cemetery in the village. It's been recently honored with a National Register designation, and about 50 years ago, or say 45, 46 years ago, we're at the cemetery now, and people listening might know it if they've ever come to the Little League field in Kinderhook, because it's right adjacent to it. There are people who say, I never knew what that cemetery was. I always saw it, and I always wondered. So now we have a sign board placard that tells a little bit about the history of it and explains that more. And it's been tidied up somewhat, and there's new fencing that shows the outline of the entire cemetery, which was a quarter of an acre, some 280 feet or 260 feet long, and about 40 or 50 feet wide. That land and the configuration for it was spelled out in the will of John Rogers. Rogers lived in a big house that still stands on Broad Street today. He was very prosperous. He was a bachelor. He had nieces here who had married entrepreneurs and manufacturers in the village. So John Rogers allotted this quarter acre for persons of color to be used for that purpose in perpetuity, he wrote. And so it is. By about 1875 or so, this was filled up with burials, and the black community in the village had been set out to raise funds to buy neighboring land. How that fundraising went, we don't know. The report of their interest in it is given in the paper, but then there's never anything more said about it. And today the AME congregation doesn't survive. The records for it don't survive either. John Rogers died in 1816, so the cemetery dates from that time. And we've had an archaeologist here to help us identify the nature of the burials and their possible location. When we put the sign in the signposts, those have to be dug and set in concrete. So what the archaeologist could do for us was to probe around and make sure that we weren't getting into anybody's grave. And as a matter of fact, the first part that he dug in, he did find grave remains, which we had to move that over a little bit from where we wanted it. So we tried to be very careful in that regard. We have plans to put in a new fence here, but here again, we're approaching it somewhat differently because we can't really put anything in the ground. So it will be a barrier of sorts. I think it will work out well, though. A kind of concurrent with my interest in the history of the place, it happened that one woman, a neighbor here, Hollis Seaman, and then some friends of hers who also are interested in things in the village, Warren Applegate and Kathy Long, they were concerned about the gravestones, which were badly stained with black gunk from air pollution, presumably from exhaust fumes from cars. So they cleaned all those stones slowly. That's done with distilled water, a soft toothbrush, and just gentle cleaning until it's done. Very tedious, slow work, but they did it. Every stone there. Most of the stones we've been able to read. Kathy and Warren made gravestone rubbings, and a gravestone rubbing, which is done with a soft cloth and a black waxy crayon kind of thing, it shows often things that you can't really see where the stone has been worn by pollution and deterioration. So they were able to get a good reading for all of the stones. Part of our signboard over there has got a little a map of the cemetery, and it tells basically the information that's on each stone. People look, and if you look, you will see that the stones, it suggests that people have very short bodies. But the stones were moved. They were from all different places in the cemetery. Most all of them were knocked over, some even face down. And they were set up here by Kinderhook Village DPW and the Boy Scouts. In the mid-1970s. And the reason for setting them this way was to make it easier for mowing to occur. This had been covered with sumac and other, it was just a completely overgrown jungle. And, you think it seems like you're pushing yourself a little bit to make it convenient for DPW to mow. There's a good reason for wanting to keep it mowed and in good condition, because otherwise the opposite happens and it gets very bad. So, and is that part of the cemetery? Of the people who are buried here, we have one Civil War soldier, because he has a number, and you can tell that he was in a Civil War regiment, but his name is not on there. I believe we have a clue, because we've been able to identify the list of, or names of, several Black Civil War participants from Kinderhook Village and also from Stuyvesant. And we think it may be one of those. There's Isabel Leggett. That's the stone over here, the most elaborate stone, perhaps. And it tells on the stone how the stone was put in place by the women of Kinderhook, because out of gratefulness and appreciation for all that she did for them. We don't know what she did for them, although it's a reasonable surmise to think it was that she was a good midwife for many different women. So that's quite interesting. And then there are several children and a wife of Peter Burgert. Peter Burgert was a lay minister, meaning that he preached when there wasn't an ordained minister present. He also worked in the village. He was a gardener. He's records and mention of him in other family memoirs hint that he was something of an herbalist and knew a lot about medicine that grew out in the wild. Some of it he may have learned even from Indians. But in any case, that was Peter Burgert. He is related to the Burgett family of Great Barrington, and very likely descended from slaves in that family from the 18th century. There's a Springsteen and some others here. I've been able to trace most all of them in the census in one place or another. And one of the things that turns up, you immediately think, well, these are people who live in the village. And indeed, some of them did, but others, in fact, lived in Stuyvesant, where they were farmed, and elsewhere, mostly Stuyvesant, some in Ghent. Before 1823, when Ghent and Stuyvesant were broken off respectively, Kinderhook had been a much larger place. But there was no village, it was just the whole township of Kinderhook. So when John Rogers said in his will that this was to be set aside for the colored people of Kinderhook, he had this larger vision in mind, or a larger geographic region in mind. So that's about, I think, most of the general story. As you probably are aware, slavery was something that was introduced barely by the Dutch, and it was heavily introduced and encouraged, fostered by the English then. in the late 17th and over the 18th century. The Dutch had some slaves in this area, but not very many. And they were mostly owned by the Dutch West India Company. And say like Peter Stuyvesant or whoever was in charge would have them kind of under his direction. And if you were building a bridge or a road or some other project, maybe he would send them to your community for them to work. He sent them to Albany, for example. How much, if ever, any, if they ever came to Kinderhook at that point, is not known. There's no record that they did, but of course it could have happened. When the English took over, it became evident to the English pretty soon that a place like Kinderhook, for example, and certainly a lot of others, would never be developed because the population was so small. And slaves coming to work were the best way for things to develop and grow and become viable or economically important. So that's how slavery began. And the English really pushed. They would bring slave ships in and want people to buy them. And so that's how that happened. It's a really, in ways, I think it's hard for us to understand. It's, if you will, frustrating to appreciate how really horrible the black people who were arriving here, perhaps knowing none of the spoken language, having been removed from their home and families in Africa. Maybe they had been kidnapped twice. There were actually some countries in Africa were capturing and enslaving black people before they even left Africa. And then at the ports, they would sell them to Europeans who would then bring them here. Slavery was always controversial, especially with the Dutch, less so with the English. Along about 1714 or so, it seems like the population of slaves begins to explode, and many more are imported at that point. So they did bring to this area certainly great prosperity in terms of agriculture. That was most of what they did. In cities like, say, Albany or New York, slaves might also live in households and learn a trade, such as shoemaking or tinsmithing, other artisanal trades, which could hold them in good stead. Both here and in the city, they seem to be given an opportunity to work and earn a little bit of extra money. There are examples where Joe Smith's slaves are loaned to a friend for them to do work, and they're paid. And the slave seems to be paid, not the owner of the slave. Once in a while, it seems like the owner of the slave was paid. But we don't, or at least I don't know enough about that. Records that would clarify things like that are really sorely lacking. And in that way, it's quite frustrating. You think you're onto something, and then you find something that, whoops, well, it couldn't have been like that all the time. Maybe this is the only example. You have no way of knowing about that. But it's a very sad, a very bitter history. In 1797 or so, abolition in New York went into effect. And there was to be, it was called gradual manumission, meaning that the slaves were freed gradually over basically a generation, and it would become finally done in 1827. So that was controversial because it was so slow, but there was a little thought and wisdom behind it, namely that if you had just said, okay, you're free, that meant you would have turned out of assaulted wife for in many cases. Women, elderly people, young children, not so young children, who had no way of, they had no way of knowing how to act in a community. They weren't prepared for to find employment. There were no employment opportunities for them. So the idea of this gradual manumission was to prepare for all these things, and they did. New York's manumission was not the first, but it was among the earlier ones as it began. In 1790, there were more than 600 slaves in the town of Kinderhook. Again, the much larger town of Kinderhook. That was more than a tenth of the population. The village itself, you can go through the census and see where slaves were, and the village would have had maybe 40% of its population was black at that point. So there were many people. And these are an example, as I mentioned, of where maybe slaves would go and work for someone else. The church was doing repairs, updating, modernizing of its parsonage. And one man's slaves came and worked as carpenters and as people who could move lumber for the house and bricks. It was used in that way, but there the slaves were paid. They were also fed and sometimes lodged if they happened to be far away from home. So that's kind of the system that worked under. Peter Van Ness, who built Lindenwall, the house that became that, he died about 1804. And he left, he left his slaves free, except for one little girl who must have been a toddler, younger than 4 or 5, to his wife. But that was part of this gradual manumission. He couldn't have let the girl go free because he would have frozen to death. You couldn't assume that child's mother even lived at Venice's, although she may have. But if she was free, she might have no means to take the child with her. So basically, Mrs. Van Ness, the widow, was left with the responsibility of that child. And what became of her after that, it hasn't been possible to trace. Mrs. Van Ness lived for a while longer, but not that much longer. But she doesn't mention this child in the will. So we don't know if there was a good ending or a bad ending for her. By the time Washington Irving visited, he was the guest of not Peter Van Ness, but William P. Van Ness, who inherited the house and was able to entertain his friend there. And of course there were no slaves, although there certainly could have been black people living nearby or even on the farm who did work, but they would have been paid. Their arrangements would have been a little bit different than they were under slavery, although not necessarily a whole lot better. But maybe, there's not that kind of record survives, unfortunately. On the other side of the creek, a neighborhood that had large farms, some of them owned by Van Alstine, a lot of slaves worked, and it was a place where black people tended to stay and continue agricultural work until late 19th and early 20th century. We can tell that from the census. Now, they were not slaves, but the agricultural work they did there must have been satisfactory and satisfying to them, because that's what they had. They were certainly part of a smaller community in the neighborhood of Sunnyside. Some of them are buried here. We can find the name on the stone, and we can find them in the census, and you can kind of plot out where they live or lived at the time. So there are a variety of approaches for studying and learning more about this. It's very interesting. It's very sad. It's very challenging. The idea of being owned by somebody and not at liberty is really frightening. I think there's a sort of not very kind thing being said about the United States at this point among people who are very rigorous in their research of history. But it's harsh, but it's a great country because it was built on stolen land, built by slaves on stolen land. And that's a tough history to have.
There were African Americans here in the early 20th century from census. They continued.
Yes. Between 1840, 1830 and 40, which is when they first appear in the census, is after manumission, their numbers decline. But there have always been some black people living here.
And there may be some descendants still here, and do we know?
I'm not sure. I don't think there are any in the village right now. There might be nearby. Hmm. But when I first moved here, there were some.
So it's interesting. It changed. Today there's less now than before.
Yeah.
In this in Kinderhook.
I think so.
Ruth, this is a interesting story about the African Americans who were part of the history of Kinderhook and helped build it.
Whole area, really.
Yeah, helped build it. So I want to thank you also for the interview today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you so much, and my audience, this is, again, I'm interviewed Ruth Polanka, a village historian of Kinderhook.